Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
Well, it's Wednesday, the 19th of January, 2022, and this is Reconstruction with David Taylor and Phil Bishop from the Construction Index. Good morning, everybody, and good morning, Phil. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, David. How are you doing?
I'm not so bad. I'm delighted to see on the Construction Index website this morning a story which makes one of my 2022 wishes come true.
You're talking about Crossrail.
I am. If you remember last time we spoke, we had an informal wish list of what we hoped would happen this year. And top of my list was that there might be some movement on Crossrail or the Elizabeth line, as it is now known, of course. And yeah, there's Mark Wilde, the boss of Crossrail, has said that they hope to open it to the travelling public in June, by June. So that's great if they do that.
I wonder who'll be Prime Minister to cut the ribbon.
Yeah, I wonder. Well, we'll wait and see. There's so much to look forward to.
Well, when's the Queen's, what is it, Platinum Jubilee this year?
Oh.
Could it be timed to coincide with that?
That sounds suspiciously coincidental. Yeah, I think it is June, isn't it? I don't honestly know. I haven't checked that one. But yeah, that would work nicely, wouldn't it? Well, maybe they'll shuttle her backwards and forwards on it so that, you know, she can wave to people on the platforms. That'd be nice.
But that's not the biggest story of the week, I don't think.
No, it's not. It's a nice story, but it's not the biggest. And the biggest is, Phil?
By my reckoning, the biggest story of the week is that Kia is allegedly in talks to buy Tilbury Douglas Construction, or Interserve Construction, as was Tilbury Douglas. Now it's reverted to that name. We talked about that before. There is absolutely no confirmation of this. Neither company has made any statement or comment. Any conversation we have today, because we're talking on Wednesday morning, risks being overtaken by events, because tomorrow Kia is scheduled to put out a trading update to the city, and it may have something to say on this report. But normally, when reports of a big deal like this happen, there's some sort of stock market announcement immediately saying, you know, yes, we acknowledge these reports, and either there's no truth or there's some truth, but we're a long way and we'll keep you updated, or whatever. Mm-hmm. I know the Times newspaper is saying that the absence of official confirmation or any recognition, any response to the initial reports suggests that we're not that close to a deal. But the initial report came from Sky News, and Sky News has a pretty good track record. I mean, it's not generally my go-to source for news, Sky News, but I have to give it credit that I believe they might have been first to report the Interserve selling off RMD Quickform last year. And I have it in my head that they were the first to report Kia selling its house building arm to Guy Hans, the private equity man, again last year. I mean, they have a pretty good record on these things. And a story like this doesn't come out of nowhere. So someone in the know has obviously tipped Sky News the wink that this is happening. And they are saying that the government have been officially, I don't know if it's the case of notifying them or run it by them, say, this is, I'll quote the Sky News report. Sources said that the Cabinet Office had been notified of Keir's intention to acquire Tilbury Douglas. So it does seem quite a solid report, this, and one we should take seriously.
However, so we've got to sit tight and wait and see what Keir says tomorrow.
Well, they may yet say nothing, but I think they have to respond in some way. However, to my mind, it's madness. I cannot understand why Keir would want to buy Tilbury Douglas. I understand why the owners of Tilbury Douglas want to sell it. It's owned by the banks, of course, that took him to serve, fell into administration, all the, when it's a PLC, stock market listed company, all the shareholders lost their money, and the lending banks took ownership of Interserve. And since then, they've sold off the facilities management bit to, or bit, the chunk, big part, to Mitie. They sold off RMD Quickform to Altrad last year. And Tilbury Douglas Construction, the rebranded Interserve Construction, is all that's left. And banks don't want to be in the construction business. Of course, Tilbury Douglas is for sale. Now, I could understand if for someone like, I don't know, a tier two contractor wanting to get into tier one. I mean, one thinks of when Ray O'Rourke bought Lang O'Rourke for nothing, basically. He was given it.
A penny or a pound.
It was a game changer for O'Rourke. It put them into a whole new level. If someone like, you know, Keltbay, for example, which is a very ambitious, dynamic, fast-growing company, acquired Tilbury Construction, it would... I mean, I think Keltbay does quite a lot of tier one stuff, but it sort of straddles it, but it's not... Or maybe some of the other, you know, O'Rourke style concrete frame contractors buying Tilbury Douglas Construction. I could see it. That would make sense, regardless of the attractiveness of the balance sheet you're taking on. I mean, that would be reflected in the purchase price. I can't imagine that it would cost very much to buy Tilbury Douglas, because it's got a net worth of -85 million, according to its last accounts. I mean, that balance sheet has probably been tidied up a little bit since then, but its last accounts show £237 million of liabilities against £129 million of current assets. So it's got a good order book, it's got a good client list, I'm sure it's got lots of good people. But for someone like Keir, I mean... They've been burnt so often with acquisitions. I mean, that's what got them into trouble in the first place. That's what got... I mean, all the problems that the Tier 1 contractors have had over recent years. And we think of, I mean, Interserve itself, Carillion. I mean, Keir almost went under, frankly. Balfour Beatty got into an awful lot of trouble a few years ago. And it's all on the back of these big acquisitions, which are really, really hard to make work. And the only reason I can think of Keir doing it is to boost its turnover. But Tilbury Douglas Construction turnover, again, according to its last balance sheet, last accounts, which may have changed significantly, because this is the 2019 accounts we're talking about, was a turnover of £465 million, on which it made a pre-tax loss of £95 million. So it's not in great shape. I think it's probably in better shape than it was when it filed those accounts, but I don't get it. It's possible that there might be bits of, you know, there might be regions where Tilbury Douglas is strong where Keir isn't, but wouldn't it be better for Keir just to, you know, open up in those regions and, you know, tap up the local top team?
Well, Keir's already the second largest tier one contractor in the country. I mean, it's a long way behind Balfour Beatty, but it's a big player already. It's a heavy hitter, so it can't get the number one position by buying Tilbury Douglas. So,
well, the Balfour Beatty numbers you're looking at, of course, are
international.
So yeah, it's not Balfour, whereas Keir's are. I mean, a bit of international. It's primarily UK, but I don't think there's any. It doesn't matter whether you're number one or number 101. No. What basically matters is, are you making money for your owners, your shareholders or your owners? Yep. And chasing turnover, I don't know. I mean, it would... I read one, looking at some of the shareholder chat forum thingies, someone saying, well, another big acquisition, it enables them to hide losses under reconstruction costs. Some sort of cynicism out there. But all I can see, if Keir buys Tilbury Douglas, all I can see is more strife. I mean, Andrew Davis seems to have done a great job tidying up Keir. They, you know, they've got £500 million from a couple of rights. OK, the first one tanked before he came along, but the second rights issue last year, between those two rights issues, £500 million from that. £350 million from the sale of the house building division. It's not there yet. I mean, it's a lot improved. It's still there are still issues with the balance sheet, as I understand it. I'm not an accountant at Kier, but Andrew Davis done a really good job. I cannot see how buying Tilbury Douglas will accelerate the recovery and the revival of Kier. I can only see it being a bad thing.
Yeah, I certainly don't understand the ins and outs of this sort of intrigue, corporate intrigue, and I often wonder what motivates people to get these ambitions in motion. Looking at it from a layman's point of view, doesn't make sense to me either. I can't see that there would be any benefit to doing this. It might all come out in the wash, I suppose. And as you've said, we've got this statement tomorrow, which might shed some light on it, might not. But time will tell, I suppose.
I think there might be some bouncing going on. This story is being placed with Sky News to try and make something happen that might not otherwise be happening. But I can't see that working.
Well, I wouldn't know. I mean, that really is sort of cloak and dagger sort of stuff. But I'm just going to have to sit tight and wait and see what happens.
But it'd be an interesting one.
Yeah.
Don't get it. Final point on the Kier Tilbury Douglas story is it doesn't really matter what you or I think, but it does matter what the market thinks. And if you look at what's happened to Kier's share price since the Sky News report came out, there was a spike, not huge, from about 108 to 114 pence per share for Kier's share price. Kier's share price for the past, let's have a look, for the past month, it's been trundling around 100 to 110, and there was a good spike yesterday. Today, when nothing's come out to confirm or deny the story, it's sunk back down to 106 at the moment as we talk. The Kier share price. So it's not exactly set the city alight. This story, and that dip in the share price today is despite the fact that Kier has announced a big contract win this morning, a big hospital project in Luton and Dunstable Hospital, £93 million contract builder, a couple of new ward buildings there. So not setting Kier's share price alight.
No.
What do you want to talk about next, David?
Well, I want to talk about rebar, actually, Phil. It's a topic we've discussed in the past. If you remember, the British Board of Agrimont decided that it was going to certificate or certify reinforcing steels, which was the sole responsibility previously of CARES, the certification authority for reinforcing steels, which has been around for about 30 or 40 years now. Well, there's been some news on that front as well. Because CARES has announced a change in its structure, in a way. It's basically driven by the fallout from the Grenfell fire, where there's this a lot of mistrust of manufacturers being involved in the certification and formulation of standards for their own products. CARES has kicked out a couple of manufacturers' organisations from its standards committee.
Well, from its membership, I think, not just the committee.
It has expelled the manufacturer organisations from its organisation. The British Association for Reinforcement, which is obviously the company, the trade association for rebar manufacturers, and also the Post Tensioning Association, were both members of CARES. They've now been kicked out, but.
And UK Steel. UK Steel as well has, which is...
UK Steel, yes, of course.
Steel manufacturers.
Yeah, big steel producer. But key members of those organisations have been invited back to join the Policy Advisory Committee of CARES as a, I suppose, as a way of providing a non-executive role.
Well, no,
I don't know.
It's because they have the expertise. The people who know and understand rebar are not the people... the people who use it understand it.
Yeah.
And the people that sell it sort of understand it. But the real scientific expertise and knowledge and depth of knowledge comes from the people who make it. I mean, no one understands sausages more than Walls or Mr. Porker or whoever else makes sausages. And they're kind of saying, well, we don't want the manufacturers in, but we need them in. So they're keeping them around the table so that they can tap their expertise. So I can't really see how it's a bit having your cake and eat it, isn't it? I mean, I think they're right to insulate themselves from the manufacturers, yes. But they're also right to keep the expertise in them.
Well, it is a sort of a realignment, I suppose, which I think it does make sense. I take your point about the fact that the manufacturers do have this expertise, which CARES really does need. So they can't just ignore them and pretend that they don't exist. That would clearly be silly. But I suppose if they were members of CARES, they would have the same rights as everybody else. And they would, it's just a way of separating them, I suppose, putting a nice barrier up so they can say there's no influence being exerted here by the manufacturers. We're just availing ourselves of their knowledge. So they can advise, but they have no power to decide what happens.
But it seems to me in any realm, the manufacturers are the ones who are setting standards. If you think of whether it's hydraulic excavators to motor cars to washing machines, you know, whatever ISO committee mm-hmm. there is, the people who are setting the standards are the people who either they make the machinery or they're in the pay somehow of the people yeah. who make the machinery. There might be a component producer or a consulting engineer, designer working for them, but the automobile industry sets the standards, so it's totally in control of setting the standards for what cars are, and that's hence we have Volkswagen gaming the system and other people a few years ago about emissions and so on.
But there has to be some sort of impartial moderation involved, doesn't there? I mean, surely even in the automotive sector there are sort of checks and balances, and there's somebody in a sort of an adjudicator's role. You can't just leave it up to General Motors and Volkswagen, can you? And because otherwise they'd just give everything a clean bill of health.
Well, I used to as did you, when it comes to these sort of standard setting things, the area I know quite a bit about is mobile cranes. And mm-hmm. if you wanted any sort of rule change anywhere in the world, you wouldn't think about doing anything without talking to either or both of the engineering director of Liebherr and Demag, because they were the absolute world authorities. I mean, other manufacturers had good people too, but it seemed to be, because they had the dominant market share and the technological leadership. And even though there might be someone from, an HSE type of board, a regulatory kind of person, might say, well, we need to make this particular safety system mandatory around the world. They wouldn't make any kind of ruling like that without going to Liebherr and Demag and saying, is this feasible? If we set down this, can this be done? And of course, Liebherr being Liebherr, say, oh yeah, put it in, because that'll make the cranes more expensive and more sure. more whistles and bells. Let's make them more complicated and improve our market edge, I guess. So I don't know. I don't know what that's got to do with reinforcing steel, but with rebar.
Well, do you think it makes sense for them to expel these two associations, the BAR and the PTA? Do you think it's just a matter of appearances, that if they say that their membership doesn't include the manufacturers and suppliers of this product, that they can appear to be more impartial and objective in their deliberations?
I think it is an appearances thing, because whether you pay your membership fees or not, if you're around that table and everyone knows you're the person with the answers, they're going to say, now then, David, what do you think about, what do you think you should do with this? And, you're the expert and you say what should happen. On the whole, people are going to go, I agree with David.
Yeah.
And what you've done is you've still got your influence and power, and you saved yourself 25 quid a year in subscriptions or whatever it is. I'm sure it's a lot more than that.
Do we know who the individuals are who will be joining the Policy Advisory Committee on CARES? Have they said who they are? Is it just one person from each organisation, or are they fielding a team?
I haven't asked that question. Right. And I'm sure they'll rewrite the rules somehow to clarify exactly the role of these individual representatives, appointees of the chairman. So it's up to the chairman to pick whoever he or she thinks are the wise heads that they need.
I mentioned earlier that the British Board of Agremont had expanded into reinforcing steels. They're now providing certificates for rebar as well. Do you think that that has anything to do with this? I mean, because presumably BBA don't have the British Association of Reinforcement and the Post-Tensioning Association amongst their membership, do they?
We've talked about BBA before. No, I mean, it's a not-for-profit organisation. I don't know whether it's... I mean, it's industry-owned, but I mean, obviously, it's heavily influenced by manufacturers because that's where its money comes from.
Yeah.
It's funded by manufacturers. But its credibility depends on it being seen to be independent of manufacturers.
Yeah.
Not sure. Can't answer that.
Yeah. Well, I just wonder if maybe Cairns feels that it has to slightly realign itself with regard to the market in order to appear to be equally impartial.
But it what to me is fascinating is how 5 years on nearly from the Grenfell Tower fire, the fallout, the scatters far and wide in all sorts of different ways. This is clearly related to that, the whole question of who should be certifying products as up to spec.
Yeah. And I think we're going to see the repercussions from Grenfell Tower for many years to come. And in fact, is this a good time to segue onto our next topic, Phil? Because that is of direct relevance, isn't it?
It would seem to be the perfect time, David.
So what's the next topic then? I think a very interesting story.
Well, we've spoken about it before, and I think actually we need to get someone on in the next month or so to talk more about it, because it's all hotting up. The Building Safety Bill is going through Parliament. This is the legislation emanating from the Hackett report, which itself emanated from or was commissioned after the Grenfell Tower fire into the building safety regime. And the prime things in it is to create a building safety regulator as an office within the Health and Safety Executive to implement a more stringent regulatory regime for higher risk buildings. So far, so good. The difficulty is, what is a higher risk building and why? Well, in the legislation, the definition, and this has been the case since Grenfell Tower, where all the issue to do with who gets their cladding paid for or recladding paid for and who doesn't. It's all about being about 18 metres as the threshold.
Yeah.
If it's an 18 metre high multi-occupancy residential building or care home or hospital, you're a higher risk building. And if you remember, we talked about the cladding scheme, it was 11 metres to 18 metres. You could get a loan. Well, that's now changed. The government is stepping in for the 11 metre height. As a kind of coming into the high-risk category. But as far as the legislation in the Building Safety Bill is concerned, it only applies to these buildings over 18 metres in height. And the Local Government Association have come out and say, well, this is irrational. I mean, what makes a 17.5 metre high building... what makes a residence of a 17.5 metre building less deserving of all the protection we can give them than the residence of an 18 metre building? There's no difference. And they cite the case of a fire in a student resident building in Bolton in December 2019, the Cube. It was not short of 18 metres, but not much short. And... fortunately, it happened during the daytime, but the fire soon consumed the building, the staircase, the apartment, and someone on the top floor, you know, needed rescuing by the fire brigade. Now, had it been at night time, people had been asleep, the Local Government Association and others have pointed out, it could have been a whole different story.
Sure.
Now, they're saying that building should be included in the scope of the legislation, surely. And I'll quote the housing spokesperson for the Local Government Association, Councillor David Renard, is saying, "The height of a building does not define the risk to its safety, as been proven by a number of dangerous and potentially fatal fires in buildings below 18 metres."
Hmm.
And they say, we've long warned about the need for building safety reforms to avoid creating a two-tier building safety system, which leaves buildings under 18 metres vulnerable and unprotected.
Hmm.
And I think it seems to me he's absolutely right.
Yeah, me too. The strange thing about this is that, as you say, this 18-metre figure has been sort of mooted right from the very sort of outset, straight after Grenfell Fire. And I suppose without really thinking about it, I've assumed that that makes sense simply because in Grenfell Tower, there was just, I think it was just one staircase, and you know, in a high-rise building, that there's this a huge danger of being trapped and not being able to get out in a tall building. But of course, there's if you think about it, you can be trapped in a
two-story building.
Two-story building, absolutely, and it happens all the time. In fact, I looked at the Home Office has got some statistics on all this, which you can find quite easily on the government website. And in terms of, I was interested in finding out how many fatalities are caused by fires every year, and it's approximately 250 a year on average.
Are they all building fires, or are you including car fires in that, or?
Well, this is it. Last year there were this is in the year to June 2021. There were 249 fire-related fatalities in the year ending June 2021, compared with 235 the previous year. The vast majority of these, and we're talking about building fires basically, the vast majority of these were in dwellings. So that would last year, for example, just under 200 of these fatalities were in dwellings. And about 50 were in other fires. So that's
dwellings is the posh way of saying people's homes, as opposed to
people's homes. Right. Yeah, but then you know you've got houses, and you've got houses of multiple occupancy. You've got tower blocks. You've got apartments, flats, all the rest of it. And they also categorise fires by the type. And we're really concerned here with what they call primary fires, which are those which occur in a building, in a vehicle or an outdoor structure, and involved a fatality, casualty or rescue, or were attended by five or more pumping appliances. So that's a primary fire. Now, it's interesting because they actually do look at high-rise buildings, and I'll quote it here. When looking at fires in purpose-built flats or maisonettes, 17% of primary dwelling fires were in purpose-built low-rise, that's one to three-storey flats or maisonettes, 7% were in purpose-built medium-rise, four to nine-storey flats or maisonettes, and 3% were in purpose-built high-rise, that's 10-plus stories, flats or maisonettes. So the vast majority of these primary fires in blocks of flats were in low-rise blocks of flats.
Hmm.
So, I mean, you know, I think that the local government association make a very good point here that, yes, certainly it's Grenfell was appalling, and in fact 2017 really stands out as a bad year for fatalities and fires. But it seems to me that this 18 meter cutoff point seems to make high-rise buildings a special case, when really they shouldn't be made a special case. The vast majority of deaths from fires in dwellings, in flats and maisonettes at least, happen in low-rise buildings. So,
well, the Local Government Association are asking MPs and asking, I suppose, everyone to ask their MPs to support amendments to the Building Safety Bill that have been drafted, put forward by an MP called Daisy Cooper. Do you know who she is, mm-hmm. David?
Isn't she's the... Yes, I do, actually. She's the LGA Vice President. I've just read that.
Well, more so, she's St Albans MP. But I'd never I'd never heard of her, which, considering she's... I think she's Deputy Leader of the Liberal Party. It's quite... And I'm just going to check... Deputy Leader of the Liberal Party. Yeah.
Since September 2020, she's been deputy leader of the Liberal Democrat Party. So you would have thought she'd have a higher profile, but hopefully this gives her a higher profile. She's been quite involved, from what I learnt this morning, in the fire safety legislation and a lot of the post-Grenfell political movement that's been going on. So Daisy Cooper is the person who's putting forward amendments to remove the 18-metre threshold for what constitutes a higher-risk building and to avoid a two-tier building safety system.
Mm.
And yes, you're right, she's also a vice president of the Local Government Association.
It does make, it sort of focuses your attention on the criteria used to draw up this draft legislation, doesn't it? When somebody points out that actually by making buildings above 18 metres a special case, you're not really safeguarding people necessarily, even the people in those high-rise buildings. What you might be doing is disadvantaging people who live in other types of building. And
I wonder if there's an element of pragmatism, though, is that the costs involved in introducing a new building safety regime, whether it's to local authorities, central government, or to industry. If you say, OK, we'll only do it for the most highest risk buildings to start off with, and then we can, you know, when we've sorted that out, we can crank the screw and bring it down and bring it down. And maybe it was only ever intended at the start. I don't know. But it does seem odd having buildings inside and outside the scope.
I mean, another thing to point out, of course, is that although there are plenty of high-rise residential blocks dotted around the country, actually far more people live in low-rise buildings than in high-rise buildings. You know, we know that there's this big issue about the cost of replacing the cladding on all these buildings above 18 metres, which are at risk and have ACM cladding or other dangerous cladding on them. If they were to extend that to all the low-rise buildings which have been built within the last couple of decades, which also have ACM cladding or other cladding on them, then the cost would be increased exponentially, wouldn't it?
I'm just looking at what the government says about why 18 metres. And they say, we're prioritising action on buildings 18 metres and above because the risk is greater when fire does spread in buildings of this height. And I go, eh?
Hmm.
Well, yeah, but why not 20 metres? It's even greater then, you know.
It's a sliding scale, almost. Yeah. I suppose that comes back to my first point, which is that was my assumption all along, you know, that 18 metres, if you're above 18 metres, if you're in a high-rise building, you can't jump. If you've only got one staircase and a couple of lift shafts to rely on, you really are buggered in a high-rise building. So I think that probably human nature would encourage us to assume that the risk for somebody living in a flat above 18... How many stories is 18 metres? Is it six or something like that?
I think seven.
You know, you would think, yes, OK, it makes sense that you would be at more risk. But the figures don't seem to bear that out. If, 17% of primary dwelling fires attended last year were in low-rise buildings, 1 to 3 stories, compared to only 3% in high-rise buildings above 10 stories, then the people who seem to be suffering most are those who live in the low-rise buildings.
Do you know what I think a simple solution would be to all of this safety issue with getting out of high buildings? I remember as a fairly young child being fascinated by, and I can't remember where I was, but some high building, probably a hotel. There was, by the window, attached to the ceiling, was a pulley block with a rope wrapped around a pulley, which, as you pulled it, released slowly. It was, I don't know, geared or, you know, resisted.
Oh, right, okay.
And the idea is that in the event of a fire, you attach yourself to the hook and you step out of the window and it would slowly lower you down to the ground. Now, this hook block must be top 100 quid's worth of kit. If you can get out of a high building with a slow release pulley like that, we should all have them.
That's a nice idea, isn't it? I mean, yeah, you could have a sort of a wire rope hoist with a damper on it to stop it running away and just jump out the window with that round your waist.
This is exactly what this was. And I'm talking about, this would have been
early 1970s, I guess, that this thing existed.
I've never heard of that, I have to admit.
You know,
I quite like the idea.
I've seen it.
Danger there, of course, is that young boys like Philip Bishop.
I was dying to try it out
when there isn't even a fire, and just use it as a quick way of getting downstairs. Yeah, there's a danger there, I suppose.
I was told the holiday would be over if I started doing anything like that. Straight back home.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I getting back to this story about the local government association, I certainly think that they've got a lot of, they're talking a lot of sense here, because looking at the figures, that would seem to back up their position. And I do think that there's always a danger, isn't there, if you single out a particular section of an industry or of the population or something like that for special treatment, that the corollary is that you're disadvantaging everybody else, or at least another section that might be overlooked. So maybe this 18 meter cutoff point was a bit of a knee-jerk reaction. I mean, did it exist already? Was there some sort of statutory 18 meter threshold where fire regulations changed above or below?
I have no idea. I can't answer that. But
see, I'd be interested in finding out if that simply was snatched out of the air after Grenfell.
From Brussels legislation.
Yeah, something like that. Or if there was already an 18 meter thing. I don't know. But the more you think about it, the more arbitrary it would appear to be.
One of my favourite responses in any sort of moral or political argument about anything, sort of discussions you have when you've had on your second bottle of wine, is, but where's the line? Where's the line?
Yes.
And, in something like this, they've had to draw a line, and that's where they've drawn it.
Yeah, it's a classic example. Well, where's the line? Maybe somebody can tell us.
I think we've reached the line, haven't we?
I think we probably have, actually, Phil.
Right, well, we'll have to wait and see, going back to that Kia subject, what Kia says tomorrow morning in their trading statement. Listeners may already know. But for this week, and for this fortnight indeed, it's all we have for you from David and I. We hope that we will be returning to our weekly cycle quite soon. Some good news on that one.
Fingers crossed.
Maybe not quite yet. But for now, from David and I, thank you very much and goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.